shall I say, standing robot. Well, your feet came and slapped me on the shoulder, and he said, well, how are you, Harry? And I began to talk, and I turned around, and here it was the Berryman. Well, I pretty near fell over because another neighbor had told me that he had committed suicide. And I told him about it. He says, I'm better off today than I've been in 20 years. He said, I'm going to get a rest. And he says, when a place is all cleaned up, I'll start in again. But he said, I got a fair deal from the state, and I got a fair deal from the national appraiser, and we were less than $50 difference on, and he had around 125 or 30 head of stuff. He was milking 90.
So and that, he had the day before, the day that they discovered it, that he discovered this cow that had it. He bought a small dairy, just which we'd say was around the corner, but you had to come by our place, 40 acre place, and then joining our 40 acre place was where this small dairy was. And he had bought those cattle, which was clear and clean and free. He had bought those and taken them in. But when they inspected, he reported this cow. And they came out and inspected, and of course that included them. He said if I'd waited a day or two and let them keep them,
and he had paid $1,500 for a 6 weeks old bull that had his herd. Just about a month before.
But you very likely remember when you were a girl of seeing a picture of the famous Holstein cow. She was a champion cow. I guess of the world, the United States. Mm-hmm. And Fred Hartsook, who was a photographer in the Hartsook Studios, you're all up, still up and down the coast. Oh, he's been dead for many years. And he had this dairy. And this famous cow he developed his herd. He had used her to develop his herd, and he had a wonderful herd. And they were about 2 blocks from us, weren't they? They just moved into a new dairy.
Oh, about a quarter, half a mile.
And, well, close enough that Harry's brother and the two boys, or one of the boys, set up on their garage and watched them as they were driving them down. They dug great trenches. Of course, it's very sandy there. They dug great trenches and drove the cows down in. And it depended on the size of the herd. If there was more than enormous herd, like Hartsook's had, where they had two crack shot men for crack shot shooting. And he wasn't paid. She didn't draw any more than any of his other cows because of her championship. It was what she would produce. But he was paid. And the only people was the Los Angeles creamery people. And they all not only had the creamery, they had this big, enormous big dairy. They had over 1,000 head of cows. They had the Los Angeles music house. And they were not going to have, they weren't going to lose their cows. They had inspected and found that they were affected. And, well, they wouldn't permit it. They finally got orders from headquarters in Washington that those cows must be taken over. They came out with the proper papers. We're taking over the herd.
Well, the United States Marshal came and took over the farm.
And you will be paid accordingly. Now, they didn't permit anybody. They could have somebody come, but not anybody from that dairy could stand there as Mr. North stood with these other two men and estimate the value. An outsider that had no interest in them whatever was there to appraise the value of their cattle. And their cattle wasn't any better. It wasn't as good as Hartsook's cattle.
They recognized Hartsook's cattle, this wonderful herd of Holsteins, as not just milk producing. They put down the value for his breeding qualities, but they would not pay you for any ribbons that they took at a show.
Oh, Minnesota herds were really set back a long way by that destruction. Well, I want to hear how you two met when you were in the church choir. On the balcony, or what?
Oh, he doesn't know about that. First time I saw him, I don't know when he saw me first. I guess passing each other because we started to go to the church before.
You saw him before he saw you.
The church wasn't very big where we went to the Baptist church. And his sister, the mother of our children, played the organ at the church. And they, of course, you know, all the minister study and all of them, the minister study was right over the choir, where the choir was. And that's where the boys of his age and his
what did you do with this picture of the Warner guy?
They're up in the box, up in, right on top. And I saw them come out. Of course, we were up in the girls, two classes of girls up in the balcony of this little church. It's the Baptist church. And that's where I saw him first. He was a good-looking youngster then.
I bet, with those big blue eyes. I remember when I was a kid, and I was raised in Oklahoma about that time. I know how all the boys, the church was really a place for you. Mm-hmm. All the boys would stand outside while the girls walked in. And, oh. Which is you?
65 years, 60 years.
The boy?
Oh.
And that's his brother that's 2 years younger.
He lives. Isn't that an adorable picture?
My mother made every stitch of those clothes.
I'll bet.
She was left an orphan when she was 11 years old, and she was apprenticed out to a tailor and became an expert seamstress.
Oh. Well, boy, she needed to be with 8 children.
And he was still wearing these pants when I met him. That was just a little, 3 or 4 years before I met him.
That top one.
Did you decide that you were going to follow him?
No, never dreamed of such a thing. We were always good friends, and we later on, my people, there was a congregational church organized, and of course they had always belonged to the congregational church after they, when they were, lived in eastern Kansas. And then Harry's people, the church was not too far from where they lived, so they joined it. The congregational church, and that's how we met in the old city hall, one of the landmarks. Carrie City, which is part of Carrie Springs now, was my friend was the capital of Colorado, and the city hall was, of course, it had been abandoned for a good many years, and down underneath was the firehouse, and upstairs was from the city hall. So we met there for a long time, and then they finally got a church built. His folks was, my grandfather was a deacon, and Harry's father was a deacon in the church.
There were no movies in those days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the church was, all the music I remember, you know, was from the church. We never had it. I never heard any music except the church music. It was quite a culture. It was really the culture of the...
The place to go was to one of the parks and listen to the band concerts.
Yeah, it was summertime.
And we used to go down to the train to see the trains come in.
Well, we did that in eastern Oregon at the little town.
And then the revival meetings we used to have. Did the congregational church have revival meetings?
They usually would group together. The churches would group together and have them downtown because we were out of the business section of town. And it wasn't so, it was more sparsely settled. So they had a school right near where Harry's folks were, but it was the only church in that section of the town.
I always thought that it was a great stroke of genius of Ameringer's to take over the revival idea, you know, for the schools, the socialist schools that he used to have in Oklahoma. And, you know, he used to go for the whole weekend for these revival meetings. And, you know, the whole section, that big tent.
A camp meeting.
That's what they were, a camp meeting.
And the Chautauquas, do you remember the Chautauquas that they used to have?
Well, they came out of that, I suppose, the camp meetings. But then Ameringer started these big, great socialist schools in Oklahoma. I guess he tells about it in his book, you know, where you'd come for the whole weekend and they'd have singing and they'd dancing and classes and they'd have huge camp meetings, socialist camp meetings.
Where else did you live in Oklahoma?
Perry, Oklahoma. It's north of Oklahoma City. Small town. Sort of between between Oklahoma City and what is called the tri-state, you know, where the three states come together.
My father, were you living there at the time when a lot of the Dawes Commission was there and they allowed the land grants to the various Indians?
Was that before the territory or after?
The Indian Territory, and that was before it became a state.
Oh. Well, my grandmother went in on the territorial run, it was called, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, when they opened it,
mm-hmm.
shot off a gun, mm-hmm. and everybody was waiting.
Opened the strip.
She went in at a horse and buggy by herself with a shotgun by her side, and they got herself some land.
Oh.
My eldest brother was down there at that time.
Did he go in and get land? Well, that was quite. And then you had to sit by it with a shotgun to keep the plane jumpers from taking it. So you'd have to sit there until you got it.
I was just a little girl. I remember that. You know, my father, in about 1899, both my aunts lived in Washington. Well, my father grew up in Washington, D.C. And then he came west. And in 1909, his young sister, both the sisters had worked for the government.
I borrowed one yesterday.
Yeah.
And he had a very severe heart attack. And he didn't go down there for the strip, but he went down there because it was a coming section of the country. And he went down there and he went to work with his sister, the U.S. Geological Survey. He was a civil engineer. And then he went from there, and then the Spanish War came on. And he went up to St. Louis and was going to join the service and fight in the Spanish American War. And this aunt contacted him, the other aunt contacted him, but Aunt Sally was very ill, and if he wished to see her alive, well, he better come. So that was before he registered to become a fighter, and he went back to Washington, and he never went into service. While he was there, they had decided to allot this land, and which it was an allotment of land, to the Indians, and he worked on that for several years. He didn't do anything else but work on that. He was one of the engineers.
You must have been quite young when you got married then.
No, we weren't married until 19. Well, we just celebrated our
1910.
1910. Oh, I didn't know.
Well, she took a boy to raise, so she's two years older than I am.
But you know, there is one thing that he did get a pleasure out of. 2 years before,
I could claim three exemptions instead of two on my income tax returns.
So he paid.
Well, we were married over in Pendleton, Oregon. I was, had been working for this contractor on the schoolhouse. He built a three-story addition to the grammar school there. And we got through with it and we built a bank building. And the first 6 months that we were married, I had 3 weeks' work. But we were busted and head over heels in debt.
And I had come from Los Angeles, working right down on Broadway. And I wanted him to come down there. He wouldn't come to the damn state.
You had a job there.
Well, I had a job. And he stayed in Oregon for two years. About 2 years. And we went back to Los Angeles, and I didn't walk back into the same job because I was head girl there, but I had a job. And I was getting $10 a week and 1 meal a day. I worked in a confectionery store. Ice cream car and confectionery store. They're almost extinct now. Mm-hmm. Everything's a cocktail lounge.
Yeah.
And they serve merchant lunch.
You know, Debbie got a second-hand store. It made me very nostalgic. Do you remember those ice cream parlor chairs they used to have?
Yeah.
You know, they went this way.
Metal.
And the round seat. It was sort of a, but she got a table and four chairs that she uses in her kitchen, you know.
Yeah.
And they look so, you know, like those ice cream parlors. Mm-hmm. They look so, they're wonderful. I wanted to buy them from her just to, because I remember those so well.
Well, they had booths. We didn't have chairs, but they had booths, and then they had a table that sat right opposite in the middle, so it would seat four people.
Mm-hmm.
And
those were a cultural center too. These ice cream parlors.
And Los Angeles was booming. Of course, it was a small city then. And well,
was this after the war?
No, this was before the
first
war. This was
1912.
And when was the dynamiting there, the Mooney case?
That was before we were married.
No.
Oh, yes it was. You were when they dynamited the Times Building?
Oh, yes.
But
where
was that?
Mooney
was in there. That Mooney case was the preparedness.
Oh, that was up here, yeah. That was in
1916.
Yeah.
No, the Times was blown up in October before we were married, the 27th of October, just a while before I left Los Angeles.
And you were there,
wasn't it?
I don't remember the date the Times was blown up.
Yes, I know.
You were there.
I wasn't.
I had passed that building. The car, the street trolley car, came up. It was a First Street car, and it came. It went way out Sixth Street. Not sure it was Seventh Street, and came down Broadway, and turned at First Street. And at First and Broadway is where the Times Building was, an old stone building. And I turned and went out First Street. And I had gotten home, and I heard the blast, but I didn't say anything about it. Because sometimes, they manufactured, we didn't have oil wells then.
Mm-hmm.
They manufactured their gas, and we could see from where my sister lived at night sometimes why the exhaust from the gas plant would make a booming noise. And I heard it. I was out, all our toilets was out in the back of the loft, and I could see right across the ward, and I just took for granted. And the next morning my sister came in and called me, and she said the Los Angeles Times was blown up last night. And I said, why, when, what time? I said, I came by there, it was on. And she told me, and I said, well, I heard that. And of course I at about the same time why I saw this it's just like the smoke rolling up, and then when that exhaust, or there's kind of flames in the vast amount of smoke there is. Mm-hmm. And I thought that's what it was. Mm-hmm. We had to go to work the next morning. Oh heavens, the way they rerouted us. We couldn't go here and we couldn't go there. And it took so long because they rerouted the cars. It was all knocked off.
Mm-hmm.
And our cashier, usually he would get a bite to eat. He didn't eat any dinner in the evening, and then he'd get a bite to eat. And he lived up on Temple, Temple Street, and which you had to go by to go up there. Well, he was right across, practically across the street, that stayed open all night to serve the people who worked in the Times Building. And he was in there getting a bite to eat when the explosion occurred.
I never dreamed what it was going to mean to the American labor movement.
Well, it was going to mean, we used to have meetings. Well, we moved from Hermiston, Eastern Oregon, over to the Willamette Valley. And I got acquainted with a man who operated a cigar factory there. He had eight cigar makers and
would
two...
Would you like some coffee?
No, thank you.
Two apprentices, called strippers.
I gotta get started soon, I think.
And,
Make supper.
He was an Austrian immigrant, came here when he was just a little boy, and took care of his widowed mother, and he was quite a socialist. Well, we organized a socialist local in McMinnville, and used to have street meetings in front of his cigar store. And of course we were defending the McNamara's and explaining it, and Yamhill County is predominantly a farming county. and McMinnville is the county seat, and it's one of the richest, most fertile counties in the state. And Lord, what happened when this admission of guilt came? What a blow it struck to we who had been defending them. And there was a fellow that his folks wanted him to study law at the university, and he took a part of the year in law, and he got so disgusted that he took up economics, and when he graduated from the university, he became state organizer for the Socialist Party. Well, we had a meeting in McMinnville in the old opera house, and it was packed, even the standing room, and it was the first job that I had gotten after we were married, and of course I was a goat again. I was chairman of the meeting that night, and I had worked a couple, 3 weeks driving a team on a dump wagon, delivering gravel to the various jobs around town. And the meeting was Friday night when this friend spoke, and Saturday night I got fired, so I had to get another job. We've had many ups and downs, and occasionally we'd get a few dollars ahead and maybe a start on a little home, and then something would come along, and as we used to say when we were kids, you just spit on the slate and wipe the figures out. And today we haven't anything in worldly goods, but the little home that we have now is in a co-partnership with the Savings and Loan Association. But when we look back over our life, it has been indeed rich. From the time that I sat on the tailgate of Bill Ennis's express wagon, when I first met Mother Bloor, and the many good people I met in the Middle West when I was back there 2 years, and the associates that I have today in the progressive labor movement. And I have no regrets whatever. Sometimes when we look at people of our own age that were kids when we were kids, and they have amassed acquired a little degree of security, much more than we have in the financial way, yet our life has been much richer and fuller than theirs.
Seems to me that the longer I live, the more it seems that people who live for themselves alone are most miserable. They seem to, as you say, they have worldly goods, but they're very poverty-stricken in their spirit.
The memories that we have are priceless. You can't measure them in money. You can't measure them in with a yardstick. While our opportunity to go to school was limited, my father, speaking for myself, my father worked 10 hours a day for $1.75, and he couldn't support a family on that, and I went to work when I was 14, and I have paid my own way ever since. I never have lived off of anybody, and nobody ever gave me anything. What little we have was made with our own hands, and it didn't come from exploitation or rent or interest or profit. I wouldn't trade the memories of the people that I have met and the people that I have known, and that I can say, well, here is my friend. Not long ago, a very good friend that we knew became very ill, and he wasn't expected to live. But he did. He lived, and later there was a short period of time, there was a reoccurrence, and he died. And they lived quite a distance from here. And we got a telegram one night that he was dead, and that they wanted me to speak at his funeral, which I did, and I think it was one of the greatest tributes. Before he died, he told his wife that he wanted Harry to come down.
He was one of the first ones to have this aorta
transplanting.
Mm-hmm. And they operated on him, and he was in the hospital, and they didn't know whether he'd live or die for days. Palo Alto, which is Stanford Hospital.
It's a friend of Walter and Wilma.
And they're finished people. And this Alba that you heard is here, like we heard, maybe you met her over there. She's a little woman. It was her husband. And he was...
She was at Berkeley. You must have met her.
He was... he recovered, and he looked... When we saw him after he came home from the hospital, they didn't think for days. And I guess all the heart doctor, heart specialists and doctors that have anything to do with the heart, I guess, came in and observed his case. And he fully recovered. And had he gone back to work?
Mm-hmm.
And he was a painter. And then this evidently it just was to the place where he couldn't go on. And they operated, but they didn't give her any hope at first. But he got so that he was just his normal self in every way. You never know that he ever had anything the matter with him.
But he died of the heart.
At the cure of this condition.
Do you have a copy of your sermon?
No.
I suppose you just talked off the cuff. Huh?
4 minutes, you know.
Now that's where you should have a tape recorder to take down.
Well,
those kind of things.
And then Walter.
I think I can remember most of it.
Then Walter said, graveside, Walter said his say. Of course, they've known one another. We met them after we came here. But to me, the things that went through. When we were first married, he tells you about being fired from this. And he was advocating what we're enjoying today. Mm-hmm. Old age pension, which came first. And, then Social Security. And
unemployment insurance.
Unemployment insurance. There goes that crazy damn socialist. And no matter who, if you had a socialist attack, anything socialistic attached to you. Why? Well, he's a damn socialist, that's all. And now, these people, not too long ago, I was on the bus coming in, and the woman who was almost old enough, that was before the 62 age came for women, and she was old enough that she was going to get her rocking chair money. And the bus driver is... He has quite a ways to go, I know, before he'll get any Social Security. And she kept talking about it. Well, I guess she rode with him every day when she got through work, because she goes to work early, and somebody takes her to work, and she works in a bakery where they make chicken pies and fruit pies and things like that. And then I'm going to get my rocking chair money. I'm going to retire and get my rocking chair money. And she kept talking about the rocking chair money. And I couldn't help but think of some of the unpleasant things and experiences that I had gone through, because that man there was fighting for those things. And I said, yes, you're enjoying it, aren't you, like all the other people are. Oh, she says, well, I'm not yet, but I'm going to. And I said, I don't know whether you were one of those people, but I said all kinds of epithets were said about people and thrown at people. Or because they advocated that very thing. And you call it not insurance money. But I said, just remember that the ones that fought for it fought very hard, and all kinds of nasty things were said about them. But they take it for granted.
You know, we had something here that I'll give you that. I can give you most of what I said at Hans's funeral.
But just a moment before you begin, I think, though, that's what I would like to write. A book to show that, you know, that you people were the cornerstone of the future. I mean, that you made, I mean, I think that will not be forgotten, that the history will record, and honor and the struggle that people like yourselves made. Don't you feel that's true?
Yes. But listen, when he was talking about when the confession came out, that the McNamara's confessed that they dynamited, do you know why the confession was brought out at that particular time? Joe Harriman, I don't know whether you ever heard of him or not, but Joe Harriman was an attorney in Los Angeles, and he was a socialist, and he was running on...
And he'd been elected.
He was running on a socialist ticket for mayor of Los Angeles, and everything was running in his favor. And all at once it came out, and Harriman, McNamara had confessed that it was a plotted affair.
Yeah, and Lincoln Steffens pulled a boner, and he admitted it.
Yes, he admitted it.
He pulled a hell of a boner. He put faith in that damn priest, and so on.
Mm-hmm. And the outcome was that the Socialist Party started going down.
Well, you know, we have our Social Security. And now we can earn up to $1,200 without losing a month's check. Well,
I think I'll have to come to California before I'm 65 because we don't have anything like the Social Security and old age pension.
Well, you have Social Security in Wisconsin.
But you get up to $100, I understand, in the old age pension here.
Oh, yes. Well, we don't get that.
I'll limit it to 60.
We don't get that. Well, anyway, so last year I earned $1,191 and I quit. I didn't want to go over the 12 and lose a month's check because if I make a few dollars extra, we lose a month, which is around $150. So that made me eligible for unemployment insurance. Well, unemployment insurance don't jeopardize your Social Security. It's only earnings. And
gee, it's complicated, isn't it?
So I was collecting unemployment insurance, and then I went to work on a store fixture job in Healdsburg, some 14 miles up the highway, and was on it a month. Well, that made me ineligible during those 4 weeks for unemployment insurance. Well, I went back to reopen my claim, and I got in the employment office at 25 minutes past 9, and it was 11:45 before I got out in reopening my claim. Well, I was mad enough to kick the darn cages, like in the bank, you know, the cages with the windows there. But there's no place to start a one-man revolution, and what the heck do I belong to a union for? Well, we have a kind of a union here, fortunately, that isn't just concerned about policing a job and getting a job, but in an employment office. It's a really union that will go to bat for any problem that a member has in that way. So once a week, there is what they call the policy board meeting in Eisenhood's restaurant, and all the business agents of all the various crafts meet and discuss their problems and determine a policy to be pursued in the following week. Well, I spoke to our local union leader and the business agent of the district council, and I said, this is a problem for the union. They can clean up this mess. People have to wait there 3 hours to get taken care of. And I said, well, there's a policy board meeting Thursday, and you come up to the policy board meeting. I said, hell, I'm not a member of the policy board. He said, I don't make any difference. You come up. He said, the head of the employment office is going to be down there to explain the new gimmick in the law. So when we, I got there a little bit late, and the chairman motioned me to go to the end of the table and sit, and I went down there and had a cup of coffee with the rest of them. And the head of the employment office explained the gimmicks and answered the questions, and then the chairman said, we've got a number of beefs coming in from our people that they have to wait and wait and wait to reopen a claim or to file a new one. And he said, this kind of stuff we don't like. He said, they should be taken care of and not just be treated as wards or charity. He said, this money is went in there to pay. This is insurance, and they've come to collect it. And the business agent of the local union said, I was up there, just walked in the other day and sit in one of the chairs. And 45 minutes it took for three people to file a claim. Well, Then I got the cue from the chairman that it was my turn next. And well, she had begun to, this head of the employment office made all kinds of apologies and excuses and so on. And so when I got the cue at the time for me to state my case, I said, I want to give you a classic example of the utter inefficiency and the utter disregard for the people on this side of the window by those on the other side. And I explained how that I had been there from 25 minutes past 9 till a quarter to 12. And I said, here they had a man walking up and down the line. Well, let's see your paper, let's see your claim, let's see this, that, and the other. He didn't do a darn thing except look at him and I said, why wasn't he on the other side of the window taking care of the people? I said, we paid for, I said, some of us older people, we fought for these things 50 years ago. When the old manner of sneering, old epithets were hurled at us, we fought like hell to get it, and don't think for a minute that we don't have to fight to keep it, and we're going to fight to make it better. And I said, you're not going to get away with it. I said, we're going to have it, that's all. Down the street, she walked down the street with one of the policy board members, and he told me afterwards, he said, she told him that what that man said this morning brought back to mind the time that I was on relief during the Depression. The following Monday, when I went up to get my unemployment check, they had one window with little filing cabinets, the documents to fill out for your reopening your claims, another window for filing new claim, your forms were there, and the man out in the row interviewing the people that were waiting to get to the window, he looked at it and he helped them fill them out. He went back and got another paper, and I said, it took me 3 minutes to get my check. I looked at the clock on the wall. I said, we got it. And that is the kind of a union that we have here. We've got a lot of reactionary people in it, members. We've got people in it that don't understand. A union to them is just a place to come and get a job and so on. But there is a good number of members that know what we say is...
Well, one of the important things is that the younger generation doesn't know the history of these struggles. That's why what I'm trying to do is to try and get, you know, in some popular way that would be exciting and people will read it.
Now,
they don't know the history of these struggles. What struggles it took to make the union.
We elected a committee in the local to prepare a resolution on the unemployment situation in unemployment insurance situation. And we prepared a resolution, and in that resolution we demanded the Governor Knight fire the state head of the employment office, a man by the name of Burkhead, who was had issued an edict that you had to get the signature of 5 different employers before you could collect your check. Well, it hit the front page of the paper here in Santa Rosa, and Governor Knight refused to can him. Yet, less than 3 months later, he got kicked upstairs into another job, completely disassociated from the state employment office, and we got a new head in.
So, but did you, in your funeral sermon, did you speak about this socially conscious man that we were talking about? Was that your theme?
I read some time ago, well, I don't know whether I can quote it verbatim or not, but I started with a quotation of Ingersoll on Tom Paine, one sentence. To speak a word of praise for a kind and thoughtful friend is always a labor of love and gratitude for me. Hans Johnson was my friend, as he was the friend of all mankind. He recognized no distinction of national origin, no color line. He loved people. He was a good, honest, working man. faithful member of his trade union. His workmanship was complimented by all who associated with him. What he did well. And I don't remember whether I can give all of it or not.
Was he a carpenter?
A painter.
What painter?
Dennis spoke about his work for peace and brotherhood among all peoples, and that he knew where he belonged. His whole life had been lived and devoted. You see, he used to be National Secretary of the Finnish Federation. And,
Hans Johnson?
Uh-huh. Did you know him?
I've heard of him.
Yes, it was Hans. Then there was a, I closed it with, mourn not the dead who in dead in honor lie. Let's see, how's that going? Mourn not the dead who in dead in honor lie.
Is that English song?
Uh-huh. No. Just shut that minute now and refresh one.
Well, another history I'd like to write is the history of the women who followed these men, as you say. You know, every time I'd ask Wilma, you know, about something that I was talking to Walter about, and I'd say, now, well, what do you remember about that? And she'd say, well, I was in the kitchen. You know, we were serving huge meals. I didn't hear that speech.
It's like we used to in Minneapolis. It got under my skin one day, and I was glad to help you all I could.
I gave the notes. All of them wanted the notes, and I gave them to her.
Oh.
That is, do not, I pray you, mourn the dead who dead in honor lie, for nature has but claimed her own, all mortal bodies die. But toll a mournful bell for them who nothing leave behind, no book, no song, no deed, nor dream enriching all mankind. And Hans has left in his life's work something behind. We'll never forget his labors for brotherhood and his labors for peace and the equality of all those who work and toil and have made this world that we enjoy today and so on.
Well, I think that holds true for all people who put their energies into social good. Don't you think so? That's why you feel that. You were telling about Minneapolis when you got mad.
Well, I didn't want to have those party dinners. And by the way, before I forget it, do you remember George Sharp?
Yes.
Is he still in existence?
You mean Clarence Sharp?
No, Sharp.
Sharp.
Sharp. Sharp.
Oh, Sharp. Oh, yes.
George Sharp. The big heavy set fellow. They lived right off of.
Glenwood.
On Glenwood.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't think he lives there anymore. I don't know what...
They had some apartments there. Mm-hmm. And he used to always help. He was so good about coming down and helping. I don't know what the women would have done if that had been for him. He'd always come down and help.
Well, you know, now we have dinners and we alternate. The men make one dinner and the women make the other.
And you know, they'd all come in. And then, well, is it ready to serve?
Mm-hmm.
And this night, well, why? Why are they late? And, well, they all was rather timid about it. And it had been growing on me all day. And I'm so short of help, and we were working this so hard. And I think it was, I'm not sure, but I think it was when we were still in the finish hall. And, I don't know just where it was now, but I think it was in the finish hall. And we were cooking, and George was there, and somebody else, Wilma, was there, Mrs. Hale, and so forth. And I said, well, now listen, if some of you people, instead of sitting uptown all afternoon, would come down here and help, we wouldn't be delayed. We'd have plenty of help. We always have plenty of help, but it's ready to serve, but nobody's ever ready to come down here and help get it ready. And another fellow that was head there, what was that little fellow's name that his wife is out here at Astoria now? They separated.
Oh, Jimmy Flower.
Oh, yes. Oh, do you know her? Do you see her?
She was here occasionally on a Christmas card. She thought she'd be down.
Oh, I'd love to see her.
All the children are here, down here.
I know.
With her.
That was too bad after all they went through.
And you know, she married. And she married a fellow that was quite a bit older than she. But he ran a bar in
Astoria. He's a slow guy.
And she came in there. And she was so despondent. I don't know. I guess she just thought, well, she wanted to get as far away as she could. And of course, she knew the settlement there. And she came out there, and he told us about it. Well, the first time we met them. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't alone that time, was she? No, she was home with the baby.
Did she have more children?
She had two children by him.
Oh. Did she have five before, didn't she?
Yes, I think so. And you know, Marietta used to go down and Harold Stone, and she used to go down and babysit for him so that they could go and do it.